going to examine what I called in the title Shem Yefes and the True Story of Hanukkah. In order to properly understand the way Chazal view Yovam, the spiritual and physical descendants of Yefes, one needs to look at various places where there are references to the Arba Malchus, the four Golios, are referred to obliquely, or at least from the references identified obliquely by Chazal. Are two well-known examples in the second pasuk of the Torah, Oritz Choyso Soyva Voivu. The world was chaos and void. V'choshech al pnei sahoim, darkness on the face of the deep. V'ruach Elokim racheches al pnei hamoim, the spirit of God was hovering on the face of the waters. And it's well known that these phrases, Tohu v'choshech pnei sahoim, are understood to be references to the four Golios. I think the context from a more, esoteric perspective is that we begin with Bereshis, the concept of a God in the world, the ultimate notion that the Kodesh Baruch Hu controls and is responsible for everything. But there are forces that will exist throughout history that will oppose that notion. So, V'ho'oris, but in contrast to what we've just seen, and these ideas will play themselves out at various stages in history. And so, Choshech, darkness here, is understood in the context of these four Golios, these four opposing forces to the divine. Choshech ze Golos Yovan, a well-known Chazal, that this darkness is great, and of course very nice, and of course we celebrate Hanukkah to vanquish the Greeks, and we light lights which pushes away the darkness. These ideas are very familiar. Shechshichei Nein Shel Yisro B'Gezeres Seyam, because they darken the eyes of the Jewish people with their decrees. And they went on to, well known, it's a different subject, Kisfu Lochem Al Keren HaShoyer, Shein Lochem Chel Bele Yisrael, you should write for yourselves on the horn of an ox that you have no portion with the God of Israel. We're interested that Choshech here is Yovan. There was another reference to the four Golios which is less well known, in Parshas Chukas, the Pasuk describing those details of the Paraduma on the phrase Asher Ein Bo Mum, it has no blemish in it. This is very different. Asher Ein Bo Mum, according to Zayah Kodesh, Dor Malchus Yovon, this refers to the kingdom of Yovon. And here is something completely different to the other Chazal, and we're going to struggle, I think, to reconcile the two statements. De'inan Kerivin L'Orche Din Hem Nusa, because they are close to the path of truth. This is very troubling. One, darkness have nothing to do with God and Torah and Judaism. That's the first reference. The second reference seems to be saying that they're close to the path of truth. When the Zohar says that they're close to the path of truth, it must mean they're very close. It must mean that they are, in some respects, concerned that we might confuse them because they're so close to the path of truth. And in fact, obviously, that's a reading. Ein bo mum, it has no mum, it has no defect in it. It's almost perfect. Inam kravin l'arche de mehem nusa. They're close to the path of truth. And reconciling these things are quite difficult. And so I don't think we can really advance in our understanding of Yovan, and therefore what Hanukkah represents, our celebration of our victory over Yovan, unless we're capable of reconciling these two ideas. On the one hand, it's darkness, destruction, absence of light, and all the evil that we would associate with it. On the other hand, they appear to be close to the path of truth. There's a bit of a hint. There's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah which refers to the dating or the particular formulation of shtoris. Why certain halachic documents should mention HaKadosh Baruch Hu in them. This is the Gemara. Gozru Malchus Yovan Shmad, the Greek kingdom decreed against the Jews, Sholahazki Shem Shemaim Al Pihem, they should not mention God's name at all. Ukushagovru Malchus Chashmonoivan Itzchum, and when the Hasmoneans prevailed and vanquished the Greeks, Hiskinushim Afkim Shem Shemaim Afil Bishtoris. Chazal, as part of the celebration, said that not only are we now going to mention God's name, but even in documentation, even for mundane matters, even for land transactions, even for buying a house, even for a loan, but there appears to be no reason whatsoever to mention HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even in simple shtoris. A glass of water would be appreciated. This thing sorted. It's fine. It's fine. This thing done now. Thank you. Even in mundane documents, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be invoked. This is rather interesting. The suggestion is that the Greeks want to prevent any mention of HaKadosh Baruch Hu at all in anything. And the consequence, thank you very much. That even in mundane matters that would not naturally even be would not invoke Kodesh Baruch Hu, it's all simple transactions, God will be mentioned. So we're going to try and tie these ideas together using using a couple of Chazal and some later sources as well. The key posuk on all of this, which is I think widely misunderstood, is the bracha that Noach gives his children. As it comes out of the Teva, the world is to be divided not just between three sons, who are going to repopulate the world, but these three sons represent three distinct strands in humanity. We know Shem will be the antecedent of the Jewish people. We are Semites because we are descendants of Shem. And at least, Farry, we're not interested in Chavin in the story. We're interested in Yefet. Yefet is a forerunner of the Greeks. And the bracha is interesting. Chom's blessing is in a posuk by itself. But the brachas of Shem and Yefet are put together. But they somehow that they are interlinked. Yaf Elohim Yefet. Although Rashi translates it, this Yaf means give breadth. God will give space to Yefet. There's obviously a sense of beauty. Yefet here means beauty. And we can identify immediately this blessing as the forerunner of the achievements of the Greeks. The aesthetic, the emphasis on the physical, on literature, philosophy, music, the development of the intellect, even on the beauty and prowess of the human body, the sports, the Olympics, and so on. Yafta Elohim Liefes, the Yishkoin Baalei Shem. But and, however you want to read it, he will dwell in the tents of Shem, the Chanan Evid Loma, that Canaan will be a servant to him, although it's treated separately. The simple reading is as follows: the aesthetic, the world of beauty, externality, will be the possession of the descendants of Yefes, but the Yishkoin Baalei Shem, but that's not where God will reside. God will reside in the tents of Shem, the tents of the family of Avram, and the Jewish people. That's where spirituality and meaning will be found in the world of Shem and his descendants. However, in the Gemara Megillah, Daf Tes on the base, there is a discussion as to the correct reading of this posuk. Rashi ben Gamliel gives a different reading to the posuk to the one I just said. He says, Yat Elohim Liefes, the Yishkoim Baalei Shem, Devorov Shal Yefes, Yihiyu Baalei Shem. So we read that means that the words, the things, the matters of Yefes, they shall dwell in the tents of Shem. We read the Pasuk originally as God will give beauty or whatever it is, aesthetic to Yefes, and he, God, as the subject of the word of the Yishkoin is God, will dwell in the tents of Shem. Rishim ben Gamliel is reworking that. He's saying that the beauty of God will give this beauty to Yefes, and if the subject of the word of the Yishkoin is not God, but the beauty of Shem. The Yishkoin Yefes, I'm sorry, the beauty of Yefes. The beauty of Yefes, it will dwell in the tents of Shem. That's a new reading of the Pasuk, a very significant reading. And Rav Shimon Gamliel is the advocate of the view that Sforim, holy Sforim, can be written in Greek, and so on. He has a whole, he's the advocate of a whole world view, which will be relevant in this context. And there are various other parallel sources, Yerushalmi, and other sources as well, Yalkut Shimoni, and so on. This is very interesting, because here, it's tying together. And this will begin, as it were, to take us back to our original discussion, as the apparent disparity between the two sources as to whether Yovan is dark, evil, wicked, occluded of any meaning, or whether it's actually close to the path of truth. The Yishkon Balei Shem, the beauty of Yefes, will reside in the tents of shame. Now, one could be forgiven for thinking that those people who advocate this source will be saying the following. There is a concept of the appreciation of the external, of beauty, aesthetic. It manifests itself in different ways. There is art, there is literature, there is music, there is sport, and so on and so forth. And we have a tendency, certain perhaps some parts of the Jewish will have a tendency to say, that these things are meaningless pursuits. They are negative, and they are a distraction from the main purpose of human experience, which from us is the centrality of Torah. I'm going to be forgiven for thinking that these sources might be suggesting a slightly alternative reading. It could be suggested, and as we know there are certainly sources that suggest so, and we're going to look at some of them in a minute, that the relationship between Shem and Yefes is not as to whether Shem rejects the achievements and the interests of Yefes, but to whether they can be sublimated to our higher purpose rather than rejected. Meaning that Yefes pursues certain ideals, certain goals, and the Greeks were the exemplars of these achievements. And it could be that the responsibility of the Jewish world is to recognize that they have value, but they never have value as an end in themselves. And what happened with Yefes is they become divorced from any higher meaning. It's the world of externality rather than the world of internality. The notion that there is no higher meaning. Kisru lochem al keren hashoyer she'ein lochem chelib elokei Yisrael. Write on the horn, why the horn's another subject, you have no portion of the God of Israel. This world is a world where there is no concept of deeper meaning, deeper spirituality. One of the key themes of Aristotelian philosophy is that what you see is what you get. Anything that I can't see, detect, measure, understand, or examine doesn't exist. The world of the spirit is absent. There is value in the pursuit of beauty, order, symmetry, even certain types of intellectual, emotional, and physical stimulation, but they are ends in themselves. That's the goal of life. If there is a world of the spirit, it has nothing to do with us. If there is a world of the spirit, it is completely divorced than any kind of other achievement, and it's something which you can go and live on a mountain and be completely, be a hermit and be divorced from reality. And therefore it is possible to understand why simultaneously Greece, Yovan is Choshech, Shechshichay Neim Shel Yisrael B'Gezeres Sehen, that they darken the eyes of the Jewish people with their Gezeres, yet in and craving the Orchid in Hemnusa, that it can remain close to the path of truth. Because in some sense their interests are very close to the interests of the Torah, and this may be the meaning of Shimon ben Gamliel's statement that you can write the Sforim in Greek, that the Greek languages are very important, in some way expresses concepts which are very similar to those concepts expressed in the Torah. There's no good in translating the Torah into a language which does not have the same concept, the same mode of approach, the same ideas as the Torah, because the translation will be unusable. It won't convey the ideas correctly. The notion of translation is not simply telling you it's possible to read the words in a different language from its original. It's telling us that the concepts the language express, and therefore the ideology of those who develop the language and who use it, are close enough to the ideas of the Torah that providing you understand the very subtle but major difference, everything will be okay. And what the sources are suggesting, therefore, is that the victory of Chanukah is not so much a victory as perhaps it can be simplified and often stated as the victory of Yiddishkeit over Goyishkeit, to put it in a vernacular way. The victory of Torah study over the wicked Greeks. It is more complicated than that. In many senses, the victory of Chanukah is the realization that the ends espoused by the Hellenists, the Misyavnim, the Jews who bought into this for the first time in history, there were no Misbablim, people who wanted to make Jews into Babylonians. The Babylonians with whom the Jews came in contact were savages. They were marauders. They were not interesting people. Suddenly, for the first time, an alternative which piqued Jews' interest was on the cards. A type of aesthetic, a type of meaningful experience, stimulus, recognition of the value of the world, of the intellect, and of the senses, and the need for order, but divorced from the spiritual meaning. It's the externality without the internality. And the victory of Hanukkah, therefore, is the realization that while these things may be of value, they are always part of a higher structure. Their goal is to be a means and not an end. Yat Elohim Yefes, but not on its own, not out there, divorced from reality. When is Yishkon Vayalei Shem? And I think one can suggest that the reason why the miracle is so focused on the menorah fits very well into this thesis. It's well known, the concept of oil. This is, you take oil, you take the olive, you press the olive very gently, you get a little bit of oil that comes out of it. It represents that there's something which is inside, beyond the superficial. But more than that, from my perspective, one of the beauties of using oil is a remarkable substance. You can rub it in, you can use it as salad dressing, all sorts of things you can do with olive oil. But when you light it, it's unbelievable. I mean, you could take a little plant, grow a fruit on it, press it, get this olive oil, put a piece of cotton wool in it, and you can literally light and heat a huge area with this tiny amount of oil. It's the unlocking of potential. It's the recognition that beneath the surface there is something extremely important, and unlocking and tapping into that potential is the purpose of Jewish experience. And it is that which is the celebration of Hanukkah, the recognition of that which lies beneath the surface, of the celebration of internality, higher meaning, rather than externality. The menorah. There's much written about the menorah. The menorah became the symbol of Hanukkah because of the nace of Hanukkah, as detailed in the Gemara. Could easily have been, I mean, I don't know if any one of them would have ever considered this, but it could have been that they were very keen that they should put the lechem upon him on the table, but they couldn't find any flour, and so on and so forth. I mean, we're just familiar with a particular type of miracle. It could have been another, and we would have become familiar with a different type of observance. But I think it's very significant that the celebration of Hanukkah is performed using a menorah. Because the menorah is not seven separate lights, although they're intended to be seven lamps, they're not seven separate candlesticks, it's one candlestick. With a central branch, with six lateral branches that come from it, they are all at the same level, the lights. That's a critical function, not just of El Menorah, but of the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash. And El Mul Panei HaMenorah Hiroes Nerisehor, that the lamps, six lateral lamps, all have to be facing the centre. This is replete with symbolism. I have pages and pages. Look at the pages and pages of Rav Hirsch, talking about the symbolism of this stuff. I strongly commend to you Rav Hirsch's essay in Volume 3 of Collected Writings on the Menorah, and in Volume 2 on Hellenism and Judaism. Excellent reading for Hanukkah. A little terse, but nonetheless very inspiring. What is the meaning of this structure of the Menorah? So the Rebbeinu Bachya, the Barbanel, the Malbim, the Netziv, in the case you feel that the Torah Derech Eretz approach of Rav Hirsch is just one way of looking at it, we have various other sources. I don't know whether Rebbeinu Bachya was a great advocate of Torah Derech Eretz. Talk about the structure and symbolism of the menorah, and understand that the menorah represents the totality of human wisdom. It represents the achievements of human beings in all spheres of intellectual endeavour, whether it be science, whether it be whatever area you wish. Rav Hirsch even tries to describe to you exactly what the six lateral branches of human study are. In the centre of all human study, of all meaningful endeavour, is the Torah. This is the only lamp where the wick stands upright. All of the others bow, as it were, to the centre, point towards the centre. This is the central, the way the menorah is described, there is a central shaft. The menorah really is the middle stick, if you like, with the other arms coming from it. All of this means that there is value in the other areas of human endeavour, of human study, provided it's understood that A, they come out from the Torah, meaning that their primary function is to illuminate the Torah. That means that they shed their light towards it. The highest spiritual goals of mankind, which are expressed in the Torah, are also to be the goals of all other human endeavour. The study of music, the study of literature, aesthetic, and so on, as an end in itself. I'm not sure I'm allowed to mention secular literature. Let's say secular literature in this forum, but I'm going to do it again. If you don't invite me back, I'll know why. I would recommend as a reading, if you ever have any spare time — I'm sure you don't, but if you ever have any spare time — do read Hesse's The Glass Bead Game by Hesse, on the what happens in a world where the pursuit of the pure intellect overtakes considerations which are outside of its own. That was Amos. Got a bit blank here, I can see. I wish you could maybe prefer between them at Sid rather than Hesse. Shamanoda Bikla Muramit Lohia Kochmosa Shel Torah. The menorah represents the illumination of the wisdom of Torah. A Bapilpul, the Hakiro, the Ion, in its various investigative manifestations. Vashisha Kene Menorah Im Hakona Emtsoi, and the six lateral branches of the menorah with its central branch. Hema Zain Chochmas Chitzonis HaTfeilim LaTorah. They are the six external types of wisdom which are not outside the picture. They're not on a candlestick of their own. They are nonetheless secondary to Torah. SheHaTorah Mashkilochem Lisparish. The Torah gives, as it were, feeds them. It gives them its. It gives them their life force. But nonetheless, they are focused on the centre in this way. And lots of other things, as I said, there's a Malbim in his Rimzei HaMishkon, which is his Kabbalistic sub-commentary to Parshas Truma, there's a Mabar Benel, and so on and so on. And so this is the concept, and Rav Hirsch loves this idea and goes to, as you know, he's very keen on the theme of the menorah. And so we can see the menorah very clearly as a symbol for the particular victory of the Jews and the Chashmonaim over the Misyavnim. One or two further observations. It is interesting to see that the menorah alone is the surviving observance of the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have a lechem, we don't have a lechem aponim ceremony, we don't have any ketores, and so on and so forth. It's interesting that this alone remains the symbol, because to a large degree it is the symbol of what's going to happen in the world of exile. It's the last festival to be enacted. It's the last vestige of the Beis HaMikdash, because the light that the menorah represents has a specific quality and has a purpose in the context of the story. It's well known as a Mishnah which talks about the breaches in the wall. I believe the Mishnah is in Midas, that there were 13 Shtachavayas, that when you visited the second Beis HaMikdash, and this is in the post Hasmonean period, you would bow 13 times. Why? Because the Greeks had breached the wall 13 times, and when the Chashmonaim were successful in rededicating the Beis HaMikdash, they filled the breaches and they, as it were, restore things to normality. So this idea of these breaches interests of Gedaliah Shoah in an interesting essay on the subject. What are these breaches all about? He says the concept is to break down the boundary between inside and outside. The purpose of breaking down a wall is to define, well, there's the wall, that means beyond the wall is outside, and this side of the wall is inside. If you break down the wall, you're saying, conceptually, that there's no distinction between inside and outside. There's no world of spirit. There's no internality and external. Everything is superficial. The outside is everything, because there is no inside. And what they object to most strongly is the notion — the Greeks objected most strongly to the notion — that there is anything internal. There is something beyond the walls, something more sophisticated than the superficial would indicate. And so, we have a celebration which is exactly the opposite. They attempted to make of the inside the outside. So instead, what we do is we take that which is normally inside and we put it in the window and make it outside. But we say it works exactly the opposite way around. It's not that the influence of the outside will pollute the inside, it's that we can take what we consider the inside and we can shed its light on the outside. That, the Kedavra Shura suggests, is the reason why this particular observance is significant and why there's so much emphasis in Halacha of placing it in a position where it's visible to the public. The idea that it will shine on the outside. So, to conclude, one or two brief excerpts from Rav Hirsch in his essay on Hellenism and Judaism, a small part of it, as I said, is on this very small printed sheet. Hellenistic thought stimulates mind and soul and aims to develop through joy, knowledge and pleasure in all that is noble, harmony and beauty as weapons to suppress brutish outbursts of passion. It makes him responsible to himself, expects him to ennoble himself by self-control, by doing away with all that is evil and vulgar, attributes that disturb the divine harmony in character and in sentiment, in speech and in deed. The Hellenistic spirit creates civilized, gentle, joyful and free men. Should we not rejoice in the fulfillment of the ancient prophecy? God will open the mind of Yefes. Should we not rejoice in the power displayed by this Hellenistic culture, which has gained increasingly control over the minds of man, by suppressing all that is vulgar and by stimulating the enjoyment of beauty? And he goes on, not for naught did God clothe the world with the garment of beauty, form the law of harmony into shapes and sounds, and he praises Yefes for having tapped into this, identified it, and in many ways understood it and measured it. And yet, Hellenistic culture contains only a small fraction of the truth which would eventually affect the salvation of mankind. As long as Hellenism is not coupled with the spirit of shame, as long as it prides itself on being the sole road to happiness, it falls prey to error and illusion, degeneration and decay. Hellenistic culture stimulates only the mind, creates only a thirst for knowledge and truth, but is unable to generate knowledge of truth. The mind revels in notions and suppositions, forms ornate and hypothetical assumptions in order to solve the riddles which face it. Hellenism considers human reason as having been created to comprehend the truth. At the same time, human reason is considered to be the initiator, revealer, discloser and giver of the truth. Although it is certainly subject to error and fallacy, it depends only on itself to reach the truth. The spirit of shame, as disseminated by the Jewish people, has made its impact upon mankind as no other force before it. Although it is only a tiny spark, it has wrought a mighty change in man's thinking and feeling. The teaching of shame refrains from making demands on man that are beyond his capacity to comprehend. The teaching of shame shows man the way to God, revealing only those attributes of God which will permit him to understand and fulfill his mission on earth. And he goes on to explain that the culture of Yefes is pleasure focused, whereas the culture of shame is God focused. I think it's something to think about.